All right, I think we are ready for our second case for this morning, Carlson against CSX Transportation. Ms. Robinson. Good morning.
May it please the court. My name is Darlene Robinson, and I represent Stephanie Carlson in this action. She is also present in the courtroom. The first question that the court posed for us to answer specifically was whether or not the court has jurisdiction over this appeal, whether or not Ms. Carlson's pro se motion to reconsider was sufficient to toll the time for the appeal. I don't think there's any question that there was a motion that was filed. She was technically represented by counsel. Her counsel had told her they no longer represented her, and she informed the court of that fact in her motion to reconsider. Whether or not...
And she went on to suggest some of the reasons why she wanted...
A number of reasons which are briefed in this matter, Your Honor. Very many of the reasons. It was a very good motion to reconsider, although maybe the typeface is different than I would have done. It might have been one that I would have done myself.
Ms. Robinson, is it correct that the district court acted to strike that on its own initiative without seeking any response?
It did, Your Honor. Well, there was a response filed, but it was a substantive response. CSX didn't claim she shouldn't have filed it.
Right, but I have trouble reconciling the district court's actions. It sounds a lot like what the Sixth Circuit did in Becker against Montgomery in summarily striking a notice of appeal because it wasn't hand-signed. And the Supreme Court unanimously reversed that.
I agree, Your Honor. The striking the motion to reconsider and doing that after the time for appeal had run, if it were not filed, seems to be just a completely unfair result in this action if that motion to reconsider did not toll the time. At the time that the appeal was filed after the motion to reconsider was stricken, and that was a ruling on the motion to reconsider, which under the rules of the Federal Rule of Civil Procedure doesn't say it has to be a substantive ruling on the motion. It says an order disposing of the motion. There was an order disposing of the motion, and the time was told. Now, the next question that presents itself is, does the Railway Labor Act divest this court completely of jurisdiction, as well as the lower court? The lower court found that it did. There's nothing that has the collective bargaining agreement. This isn't a question of I had more seniority than so and so for this job and did. You don't have to look at the collective bargaining agreement to determine whether or not she was discriminated against on the basis of her sex. There's a lot of discussion about major disputes and minor disputes and whether or not this is a minor dispute. The question is that arises and whether or not this court can look at this action is whether or not you have to interpret the collective bargaining agreement to determine this case. You don't. CSX made the decisions on whom to... Well, they certainly made the decision on whether or not to harass her out of the management training program. They made the decision on whom to place in the yardmaster positions, which were open.
Can I ask you a couple of questions about the RLA, Ms. Robinson? First of all, I assume the RLA doesn't have anything to do with the management trainee position, does it?
It couldn't.
Right.
It couldn't.
Okay.
Whether or not it bumped her back to the, and it doesn't have anything to do with her going back into...
Right. But
whichever position.
The management trainees aren't governed by the CBA.
No.
Okay.
No.
Could the plaintiff have sought arbitration for these claims? Could she have grieved this and sought arbitration for the sex discrimination and retaliation she alleged?
No, Your Honor, that's not covered by the collective bargaining agreement. Mm-hmm. Whether or not, if she had bid for a clerk's position that she didn't get, she could have filed an arbitration request, a request for arbitration grievance and gone through arbitration mm-hmm. under the collective bargaining agreement. She was going promotion or demotion from one position to another, different collective mm-hmm. bargaining agreements.
Okay. And then I understand the district court's concern and the arguments from the defendant to be, in essence, that when we get into the heart of the merits of your client's claims and try to evaluate whether the reasons for denying her various requests were pretexts for sex discrimination retaliation or honest decisions about the merits of the case, that inquiry gets us into debating about what the collective bargaining agreement means. You know, how many substitute yard masters are needed in Birmingham? How much, what are the qualifications needed,
et cetera? That's a matter of record, Your Honor, not collective bargaining agreement record. That's a matter of written documents outside mm-hmm. the collective sure. bargaining agreement. Whether or not they should have, whether or not there were four open positions, mm-hmm. you don't have to interpret anything. There either were or there weren't.
Okay. And one last question, which is a little exotic, frankly, but is the question about whether this preclusion under the Railway Labor Act is actually anything to do with subject matter jurisdiction at all, or whether it's simply a matter of the merits. Now, we said in Brown that it is subject matter jurisdiction. A number of other circuits have said that. But that was before the Supreme Court's campaign, beginning with Arbaugh was probably the most pertinent case in employment discrimination statutes to cut back on what is really subject matter jurisdiction. Do you have any views on that score?
My view is, Your Honor, that a federally protected claim, such as a Title VII claim, such as this claim, can be preempted only if it can't be adjudicated without some interpretation of the collective bargaining agreement. And that's, you know, the Hawaiian Airlines case speaks to that. The Consolidated Railway Corp speaks to that. You can't say just because the collective bargaining agreement is on the fringes of this case, we may have to look at it to see what her damages are, that that's interpreting the collective bargaining agreement.
So your position, I mean, I'm not...
Did it have to be arbitrated?
Right. That's not a full answer to Judge Hamilton's concern, because the Supreme Court has started drawing the line much more carefully, I'll say, between things that affect the subject matter jurisdiction of the court. And if the problem is only with subject matter jurisdiction, oftentimes there's another forum or another place you can go versus something that they like to call a claims processing rule that's really part of the cause of action. And if you lose, you lose. And that, you're done. And it's an adjudication on the merits. But we will ponder that.
I'm sorry I didn't answer it fully. I think that Congress and the courts have been very clear that Title VII subject matter jurisdiction is properly in the federal courts, although cases may be brought in state courts.
Yes, that's true. Mm-hmm.
And other courts, they're moved to the federal court if the other party wishes it to be so.
So I have a question for you about one of the items of her substantive claim, if we can get over all of these initial hurdles. And that is, what is the nature of the harassment that she experienced during the training program? Frankly, I couldn't see much that, as we say, rises to the level of what we would consider actionable harassment.
I think, Your Honor, if you took one individual action, one of the individual, they're listed on pages 4 to 5 of the reply brief, and actually I think they're listed in the original brief too, but all of the citations are in the reply brief. After she notified her supervisors, and her supervisors were identified in her affidavit.
I just don't see either. I mean, she's got two versions of claims here, if we, again, putting for the moment these other issues to one side. One is a set of sex discrimination claims, and the other is a set of retaliation claims.
Correct.
And she certainly has exercised protected rights in the past, so I understand at least that part. But I thought that she was complaining that she was, in effect, constructively discharged from the management training program, which isn't quite the same as a constructive discharge from a job. But
a constructive demotion is another way that I've spoken of it. She felt like she couldn't get any further in that program because although she had glowing references, done the best on the test or among the best on the test, and had comments made to her about that, prior to her letting them know about this mediation and she had a case pending, after that point in time, there wasn't anything that she could do that was right.
So you see this as a retaliation-based claim. They learn about the mediation.
Yes.
And you think they...
Although she was the only woman in the program, or, you know, I believe that it was, this was retaliation. The constructive discharge was retaliation. I don't know, maybe sex plus retaliation, a woman who asserted herself, right. but... retaliation.
And do we know from this record who actually was hired to the substitute yardmaster positions in Birmingham? She wanted to go back to the substitute.
I know they were filled by men, Your Honor, from her affidavit. I'm not sure that the names of the men were disclosed in the record.
Did she have personal knowledge of
yes,
who
filled
them? Was it
Gainey
or Greathouse?
I think that was a different. That was another position. That's someone who was allowed to transfer across lines.
Sorry.
But that is one of the people, and then the other person is another person who was allowed to go back to the yardmaster position, even though he didn't have 60 starts.
Can you explain something for me? She gets put into this substitute yardmaster position as she seems to be going through a positive phase of her career at CSX. And then she goes to the manager training program. And then she can't go back because of the 60-start thing. But she couldn't have had 60 starts
but,
as an
but that's
substitute.
Also pretext, Your Honor, that she couldn't go back because of the 60. She didn't have a right under the contract, but men were allowed to do that.
Right, okay. So because when she goes to the position at first, she doesn't have 60 starts.
Correct.
And men don't have 60
and men
starts.
Don't have, and the men who filled those positions didn't have any yardmaster training or the intensive training that's done before you work as a substitute yardmaster at all. I mean, it's the ultimate uniquely qualified argument. She had done the job.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I'm going to reserve the rest of my
okay.
time for
rebuttal. I just have one question relating to this motion to dismiss. If we agree with you that the district court improperly dismissed the complaint, is there any reason we should not rule on CSX's motion for summary judgment?
I think it would not be a good thing to do that, Your Honor, because there was no hearing in the lower court on the summary judgment motion.
And if we decided the case on summary judgment, just briefly, what evidence do you have to rebut CSX's argument that Carlson lacks seniority for the Birmingham jobs?
There is no such thing as seniority. I mean, when you're looking at putting somebody into that position, it's not she. What they said is she lacked qualifications for it. She's uniquely qualified for the job. And she doesn't have a right to go back to it under the collective bargaining agreement, which that's why it couldn't be brought as an arbitrable thing on that particular point. What she had was previous experience doing that substitute yardmaster job that other people did not have, and or men did not have, and she also had the training that you have to go through before
you
can
work in that job.
In other
words, you're saying there would be disputed issues of fact.
Very many disputed issues of fact, Your Honor, and too many to go into evidence of pretext, which also it's outlined in the brief that there are numerous issues of pretext. You'd have to make credibility determinations. You'd have to find disputed issues of fact, all of which should be left for a jury.
Well, Ms. Robinson, I know you want to save time for
rebuttal,
but this is important. I have concerns, frankly, that a lot of the evidence that predecessor counsel were offering to oppose the summary judgment motion, frankly, is hearsay or beyond personal knowledge. For example, what Gainey and Greathouse had told your client really isn't directly admissible.
The Greathouse is a document.
Okay.
And the other is a memo from him to her. It's not hearsay.
But, well, he's not an agent of CSX when he tells her about how CSX has treated him, right?
He is the person who told her.
It's a problem. And my concern, frankly, and if we agree that the dismissal on 12b-6 was premature, I'm wondering if we don't need to, in essence, remand with an opportunity for you to fix some of the evidentiary problems.
That would be wonderful, Your Honor, to be able to get an affidavit from him identifying that information. I took over the case right at the time the notice of appeal had to be filed.
Right. Thanks.
Okay.
Understood. All right. Thank you. Mr. McIntyre.
May it please the Court. Good morning, Your Honor. Scott McIntyre on behalf of CSX Transportation Incorporated. I will address the jurisdictional issue first. Your Honor, the notice of appeal was not filed within 30 days of the court's final judgment in this case. The so-called motion to reconsider was stricken by Chief Judge Young under Rule 11, and the plain meaning of strike is that the motion was expunged or erased.
So why isn't that a Becker against Montgomery kind of problem? Same Rule 11 was invoked in that case. by the Sixth Circuit.
In terms of the motion to strike,
there was no motion to strike. The court acted on its own, correct?
The court did act on its own, Your Honor.
Without an opportunity for the plaintiff to respond.
Yes, the distinction is clear in that Ms. Carlson has not appealed the propriety of Chief Judge Young's decision to strike.
Of course she has. She's appealing the whole judgment, and that all those interlocutory orders come up with it.
There has been no reference in the record to whether Judge Young was correct or not by issuing the Rule 11 motion to strike.
Okay.
So tell me
why the reasoning of Becker doesn't apply here.
I don't think that the court should concern itself with whether the Rule 11 motion to strike was granted properly in that
there was no motion.
Think of the rule that you are suggesting. There's a judgment by the court. There's a filing within the time permitted for Rule 59 or, you know, a post-judgment motion. And then after the time to file a timely notice of appeal from the original judgment, there's a disposition, that the which is the word used in the rules. And your rule expects people to have 20/20 hindsight about the exact reason why the judge doesn't think there's any merit in the motion. Maybe the judge strikes it. Maybe the judge says, you haven't presented anything that persuades me that I need to reconsider this. That's the usual set of sentences that we see.
Yeah.
It's a terrible rule. B, it doesn't fit any of the cases I'm familiar with about Federal Rule of Appellate Procedure 4. We allow all sorts of things to function as notices of appeal, and moving backwards, all sorts of things to function as alerts to the district court that reconsideration is being sought.
I would submit, Your Honor, that counsel could file to withdraw or could have filed a motion to reconsider the striking. That would have been an option in terms of the...
So you'd rather she have a legal malpractice action against her lawyer. I mean, it's crazy. I mean, she files something with the court, and everybody knows. You know, I mean, I haven't heard anything from you that to the effect that you didn't get served with this. You knew it was happening.
Oh, sir.
Right. So
it's a jurisdictional issue, Your Honor, and for that reason, that's why we're raising it. In terms of, and also in terms of drawing the line between parties filing a motion who are unauthorized to file. There is a real concern, I think, if parties are to file a motion to reconsider without being attorneys of record. And I think Chief Judge Young was concerned about that fact. Where to draw the line in future cases if, for example, a party were to file a motion to reconsider without being an attorney of record.
We do know that when counsel are instructed to file a notice of appeal, they have to do it, right?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
We do know that when counsel are instructed to file a notice of appeal, they have to do it, correct?
Yes.
Okay. Why don't you move on to the merits of the...
In terms of the constructive discharge claim, Judge Hamilton, I think you had asked a question about which claims that applies to. It only applies, Your Honor, to the substitute yardmaster position. And not all of the cases. There was a reference by opposing counsel as to jurisdiction for all of the claims. Chief Judge Young had only applied the constructive discharge, the Railway Labor Act issue, only applies to the substitute yardmaster claim and not the constructive discharge. So I wanted to make that point first.
So I want to focus in on the retaliation aspects. I think the briefing is sufficient on what happened to her with the management training program, but there are a couple of instances, open positions in Birmingham in August and September of 2009, when she's applying to be a substitute yardmaster. It seems to me a trier of fact could find that the 60 starts is not an essential criterion to be a substitute yardmaster, because CSX itself put her in that position originally without the 60 starts, and there's an allegation that there was a man who was put in that position. So that looks to me like a question of fact about the criteria, and further questions of fact about retaliation. And so that bothers me, and I'm actually also bothered by her failure to promote claim in Evansville, when she again applies, she meets the qualifications, she passes a prerequisite test, but she asserts that this was retaliation. So, you know, it just seems to me we're at a very preliminary 12B6 stage of the proceeding. I don't see where the insufficiency is.
Well, the plaintiff had six opportunities, I'll submit, Your Honor, initially to bring a claim. So
yeah,
that's
maybe
the,
she met them is what I'm saying.
That's the context. If I could speak to the issues one by one, Judge, the 60 start, CSXT Appendix 107 has the collective bargaining agreement that Ms. Carlson had attached to the EEOC as explaining her claim of discrimination.
But why did you put her in that position? She is promoted to the position of substitute yardmaster in Birmingham, Alabama, and she holds that position until January 2009.
Yes, Your Honor.
Nobody says she had 60 starts before she goes in there.
That's correct, Your Honor. That was the first time she was hired as
a
substitute yardmaster.
My point, though, is that it can't be a prerequisite to that position to have 60 starts if you move people in there. Over some period of time, perhaps, people need to accumulate that. But it can't be a prerequisite.
It's a prerequisite to return, Your Honor, which is what she attempted to do.
And she says that she's got a man who didn't have to meet that criteria.
To Chief Judge Hamilton's question, there is no evidence.
I'm the junior.
I'm the junior.
I used to be a chief judge, but I'm happy no longer to be one.
Chief Judge below. We have no evidence that a male was put in that position. And Mr. Gady and Mr. Greathouse are not, as opposing counsel had indicated, not the males in question. There is no record evidence that any male was awarded the position.
The question is, males have been put in that position, not the precise position that she wanted. But if CSX has one set of rules for women and a looser set of rules for men, then there's an actionable claim alleged for 12B6 purposes of discrimination.
But CSXT does not, as an initial matter.
A factual assertion that you would be free to support.
Understood, but let me speak to the 12B6 issue. The 12B6 issue calls into question 107, the collective bargaining agreement, because that involves the 60-day seniority, the 60-day start issue, and
not
that is
really
what Ms. Carlson alleged.
She says that well may be what it calls for, but the question is the vigor of enforcement, and that's a Title VII. Issue.
Well, on 12B6, as you know, Your Honor, we are not limited to the complaint. And we went through six complaints, and we had oral argument, and we had the EEOC record before
the
court.
Have you read Swanson against Citibank? Have you read Twombly, Iqbal? I mean, you don't have to do that much, even now, in the post-Twombly world, to survive 12B6. You've got to state a plausible claim. It's certainly plausible. Companies do discriminate sometimes.
But we're talking about 12B1, Your Honor.
Now you're off on the Railway Labor Act, and grounds on me. We will certainly consider whether any of these things are necessarily implicating. But she says she accepts, for the purpose of this case, every word of the CBA. So that is a baseline, but it doesn't mean that that's the way things are done.
Well, if we could take these claim by claim, I think that clarifies a lot, because the only issue with the 60-day seniority is her return to the Birmingham position. And that is where the 12B1 issue is intermixed with the 12B6. I don't think we can just look at the face of the complaint, because, frankly, she had six tries, and she took out her express reference to the CBA. In one of the previous complaints, she expressly alleged that the CBA was violated, and she attached provisions of the CBA to the EEOC.
So the plaintiff is master of her complaint. She doesn't have to allege the CBA is violated. The amended complaint that governs.
But under 12B1, the court is allowed to look at all evidence before the court on deciding the issue.
So why is Railway Labor Act preclusion of other federal claims a matter of subject matter jurisdiction in the wake of Arbaugh?
I would submit that this court's decision in Brown.
Brown was before Arbaugh, back in the era when lots of things were mistakenly viewed as jurisdictional. The Supreme Court has informed us. So why is this different?
I don't think the court was mistaken in Brown. I would submit that.
But discuss, if you would, Arbaugh, Stolt-Nielsen, Morrison. These are all three Supreme Court cases, and there are even more. Brotherhood of Railway Engineers, all of which have said don't call things subject matter jurisdiction. The court has the power to adjudicate federal rights and railway worker claims and the like, and there are criteria that need to be met in order to succeed claims processing, and they're important, but they aren't jurisdictional.
Yes. I think Chief Judge Young decided that he did not dismiss the claim with prejudice, I'll submit. He dismissed it because it was precluded in that she had not exhausted her RLA remedies.
What remedies did she have under the collective bargaining agreement for retaliation or sex discrimination?
She could grieve. She could file a grievance and try to challenge
alleging those violation of the CBA?
Based on her complaint. We would submit her current complaint would be, in her words, a violation of the CBA.
Does the CBA repeat Title VII?
Provide for damages and so on?
Does the CBA give a private right of action for damages for sex discrimination?
Not expressly. Now, whether she could prevail and that's not the question. It's whether it has to be interpreted, Your Honor.
Mr. McIntyre, let me ask you. I was kind of surprised not to see any mention of the Hawaiian Airlines case in your brief. And Justice Blackmun pointed out in that opinion for the court that the National Rail Adjustment Board, that is the groups to whom you would eventually go up the grievance and arbitration chain, was taking the position that it would not be enforcing federal or state statutory rights. And then we've got the Buell case where FELA remedy is excluded from RLA preclusion. All that seems to suggest to me pretty strongly that we'd be on pretty shaky ground to say that these Title VII claims would have to be pursued only through the CBA mechanisms.
That, Your Honor, is not what we're asking at all. We are not suggesting that, and the opinion below did not suggest that. The opinion
below.
And I
don't understand you at all, because she's trying to bring statutory claims that are outside the scope of the Railway Labor Act dispute resolution process. And if we're at the 12B6 stage, I don't see why the fact that there's a CBA process is here or there.
Well, our motion was filed under 12B6 and 12B1, Your Honor, a motion to dismiss. And
you've just agreed, though, that the Title VII claims are outside the scope of the Railway Labor Act process.
No, Your Honor. They're outside the exclusive scope of the Railway Labor Act process. Our argument is, and what the lower court held, was that based on the virtue of her specific complaint and the evidence before the court that she had submitted the CBA to the EEOC, that her counsel had specifically alleged in the complaint that we had violated, the CSX had violated the CBA. Based on those allegations alone.
She dropped those allegations. Why are you defying the rule says the amended complaint governs?
She did not, Your Honor, because in our appendix at 128, 344, and 345, she's referencing Section 34 of the CBA.
Well,
you're
allowed to mention
the
60
start requirement.
The Supreme Court has never said that you have to just zip up your mouth about the CBA. It can be peripheral even if it's not involved.
But that's the heart of her claim in terms of the Birmingham position.
Boy,
there is no record evidence to say that the whole seniority issue and the 60 starts, Mr. Gainey and Mr. Greathouse, it all involves seniority, Your Honor, and the CBA. And for that reason, that is why it would be precluded. Now, whether it's preempted or not, that's a different.
Well, it's clearly not preempted because these are federal claims.
Yes.
At least the way I understand that bright, rather artificial line. But let me ask you, Mr. McIntyre, with respect to your cross-appeal, how did we wind up with both a pending 12B6 motion and a motion for summary judgment at the same time?
That's a good question, Your Honor. I think it was by virtue of the court allowing 6 amended complaints and the Alabama action, the timing of it. There was full discovery. Written discovery was taken. We took Ms. Carlson's deposition. So did the suggestion as to whether to return the record to the court, I don't think there would be any basis for that because the court had a full record before it in terms of the fully developed record.
But didn't decide the motion for summary judgment.
It decided it as moot because it granted the motion to dismiss.
Exactly. So it never notices up the motion for summary judgment. There's never decent briefing on that.
No, no, Your Honor. There was briefing. It was just a matter of her brief being 2 days late and the record, the evidence actually 4 days late. We followed the rules
but
to a T.
But the court never schedules a day in which it says, you know, let's have the summary judgment. We've reached this point in the case management.
Yeah, yes, there was a deadline of October 1st for summary judgment to be filed, and we filed.
No, not to be filed. To, yeah. You know, the court bringing up the motion. The court just gets rid of it because it thinks it's moot.
Well, the court doesn't hold hearings as a general matter on summary judgment. It decides it on the record.
Yeah, but he never got to the merits on the he just never decided the summary judgment.
That's correct.
So then we can't take that as a blessing of the summary judgment motion.
Oh, no. There was no ruling on the summary judgment. You're correct,
so
Your Honor.
If we reverse and send it back, don't we need to send it back for purposes of the summary judgment motion?
I would submit the record is fully developed.
But I can't think. Can you give me a citation when the Court of Appeals has just gone ahead and been the original decider of a summary judgment motion?
I cannot give you a citation.
And particularly when this whole issue that Chief Judge Wood raised in terms of this 60 start business, it requires some interpretation, some understanding, some credibility finding.
True? Well, I would submit there's no credibility filing. That just goes to whether there is jurisdiction or whether it's precluded, in other words, for the court to hear it because she hasn't exhausted her remedies. So I would say there's no credibility issue on that. And more importantly, there's no evidence of a mail, no record evidence.
Okay.
There's hearsay.
You want to just sum up at this point?
One quick question. Yes. You've asked us to, in essence, act like the district court, mm-hmm. act like a district court, and strike the plaintiff's response to the motion for summary judgment. Do you have any factual disagreement with the lawyer's affidavit that explained his difficulty with the electronic filings over that weekend?
There would be no way, Your Honor, to factually dispute that. I would submit, though, that there were two lawyers, and the affidavit doesn't speak to why the other lawyer.
You'd agree that a district judge has the power to excuse these kinds of problems?
I would agree, Your Honor. The
I don't know if you've ever needed to throw yourself on the mercy of a district judge in such circumstances. Most of us have had such occasions.
I would hope to file a motion before requesting leave, but yes, Your Honor, it's certainly discretionary.
So why should we exercise our discretion in your favor on this?
Because there wasn't a motion filed to request the extension of time to file the motion. The pleadings were filed 4 days late.
Right,
it precipitated another round of briefings on the issue. So there would be cost associated with that. And
okay.
Frankly,
I think your time is up, Mr. McIntyre. So, and I'm going to give some extra time to Ms. Robinson to balance things out.
Thank you, Judge.
Thank you so much.
Mm-hmm.
We'll give her 4 minutes.
I would like to speak first, Your Honor, to the 60 days. I think that maybe I didn't make it clear in my briefing, but Ms. Carlson made it clear in her affidavit what the 60 days is. If you have 60 days of start as a substitute yardmaster, you are a yardmaster.
A full-blown.
Then you would be covered by the yardmaster agreement and have bargaining rights and, you know, bumping rights and whatever. Without the 60 days, you don't have a right to bump somebody. That doesn't speak at all to whether or not you can fill an open position. You don't have to have 60 starts to fill an open position.
So 60 starts, your contention is 60 starts is not a prerequisite to be a substitute.
Absolutely not.
Yard master, although it would be to be promoted into the full position of
the
yardmaster.
It is what promotes one into the yardmaster position once one becomes a substitute yardmaster if they haven't been removed for some reason. That's on page 69 of the appendix in her affidavit, paragraph 5. It kind of explains that 60 days. That's why the 60 days is pure pretext. How could she have had 60 days and be a substitute yardmaster? She would be a yardmaster by then.
Mm-hmm.
With respect to the filing of the affidavit, I just want to say that there was a request made. It was made after the fact. It couldn't be made before the fact because he didn't anticipate those electronic difficulties. And it has happened to me before. That same exact thing will happen when the system's overloaded or a file's too big, which happens a lot with documents that are scanned in.
Especially summary judgment records.
Especially.
One quick question, Ms. Robinson. We haven't talked about this yet, but the contract claim that you have, does it add, I just want you to tell me yes or no, Most settlement agreements that I've seen include anti-retaliation provisions. Does your contract complaint claim add anything to your statutory retaliation claim?
No, Your Honor, except it's a contract claim as well.
Okay, thanks.
And with respect to the pretext, I think you've touched on a lot of it. A lot of it is also in the brief itself. Actually, Ms. Carlson spoke to a lot of it in her motion to reconsider. There's just, it's not something that should be decided by anyone on summary judgment, but I'm not going to belabor each and every individual point. There are numerous issues of credibility, of factual disputes, none of them having to do with the collective bargaining agreement, except to the extent that the defendant says the collective bargaining agreement covers it when it does not. I think with that I will rest.
All right. Thank you very much. Thanks to both counsel. We'll take the case under advisement.